Today is May 1st, 2018. What is your name?
My name is Greg Gardner.
Where do you live?
Ashland, Kansas.
And what is your occupation?
Rancher.
And how old are you?
I'm 59.
Okay. When did you first become aware of the Starbuck fire, hereafter referred to simply as the fire?
That day, as I remember, I was at Dodge City getting my pickup worked on. And my brother Mark had sent me a text. I was in the Ford shop waiting room, and he had sent me a text, somewhere around 11 o'clock or so. And he said, there's a fire in southwest Englewood. We need to be aware of it. And of course, at this time, the wind was very high already throughout that day. And he said, we'll just need to monitor it. And so I didn't think too much of it because it was far away.
Yep.
And I left Dodge, but the interesting thing, when I got my pickup out of the service bay and got outside, I could already smell smoke. Well, me thinking this was the fire from the Englewood area, I'm going, goodness gracious, but the wind was so high that I thought, well, maybe that's possible. But what I actually found out, there was a fire on the south side of Dodge City. And that was the smoke that I was smelling, but that was part of one of 23 fires that were reported throughout the counties in Kansas on that day.
Did you have any trouble getting out of Dodge?
If I had wanted to go west, they had one of the roads blocked on Highway 50, but I was able to go take 283 and go south. And once I cleared that area where the firemen were trying to put out the fire, as I headed south to Mineola, there was no problem, and I was under a crystal blue sky. But as I cleared Mineola, off to the southeast of Mineola, I saw what would later be another fire that would hook up with the Starbuck. But there was huge plumes of smoke in those wind tower areas, and I thought to myself as I went through, you know, I knew that all the resources that could be moved were moved to the state line and southwest of Englewood. And I'm going, like, I knew the Ashland forces were out, and probably some of Mineola had already been called out. And I'm going, like, boy, howdy, that one's already in trouble. And I'll go, I hope they get it stopped.
could you see the fire down by Englewood yet? Could you see the smoke
not.
Of it?
I could not.
So you're mainly seeing that.
I'm seeing that.
Could you just see smoke, or could you see flames?
I could not see flames.
And so it was in that east?
It was just big, huge clouds of plumes of smoke. And, you know, they're rising larger, higher up into the sky than regular. And they were higher than the wind towers. But that being said, I still couldn't see what was in front of me for a few more miles yet.
So were you in contact with Greg or Grant or anyone?
I had actually, Grant was at his house and was doing some work in the basement. And I had called him or texted him, and he was unaware even more so than me. But when his first response back to me was, oh my goodness, it's starting to get very eerie down here. It's very dark, and things are happening very fast. And as I came through the big basin, I could see that things were about to change very rapidly, and the sky was changing.
So what about what time?
At this time period, it would have been about, if I recollect right, 1:30, quarter to 2.
Yeah.
And as I turned off, the road was already blocked, 283 going south. They had it highway patrol.
At the Englewood Junction?
At the junction. And so I went on east towards Ashland, and there's a little county road 10 that I can catch, a dirt road on the back way. And yet, you know, I was seeing something that you'd never seen before, and you knew you were fixing to go into something that you hadn't experienced. I didn't know what, but you had crystal clear sky on one side, and you were going into just utterly black. And when I got to the house, they were already starting to send policemen and people out, and they were saying, well, we were under a voluntary evacuation, and the mandatory was yet to come.
So did your family evacuate? Did Debbie leave?
They hadn't yet. And first off, I knew that running was not, you couldn't outrun this. And I knew that the safest place to be was in our nearby wheat fields. I had told her to pack some things up, and we did. And then the part of my odyssey of this deal, as it started, things started happening very rapidly. Mm-hmm. Mark called, and he had been in contact with the fire throughout much long period of time. He and Harry Walker had seen it down southwest Inglewood, and you know their reasoning was we need to let the professionals and do this and get out of their way. And right. And so Mark and his wife Eva had come back to their house, and Mary Cox had called them, and she said, "Oh, Eva said my house is on fire," and fortunately Mary wasn't there. But Mark and Eva said, "Well, Mary, we were just there 10 or 15 minutes ago. You're okay. No, please go check on it. My house is on fire." And they left and headed back towards Inglewood, and they hadn't gone very far, and they could see the flames. And they said, "We got to go back." And so he had called me, and we were going to meet. He had 3 horses left at his house. Fortunately, a lot of our riding horses had been used that day and it were a different location.
Yeah.
And so they were able to evacuate safely. And so he said, "Well, meet me at my house and we'll get those 3 horses." And then things started to really happen fast.
Okay, so where is your house from Mark's house? Or Greg's, Mark's house? Yeah.
I'm a mile north. But okay. But I have wheat fields in between us.
And he's surrounded by pasture.
Mm-hmm. Pasture runs up right beside him, next to him.
And how far is he from the event center?
Less than 0.5 mile.
Okay. And where is he from the old brick house that Strange used to
live
in?
Same 0.5 mile.
Okay.
But the corridor that to get back up into the Strang brick house, there's tree belts all the way up that corridor.
Okay.
That the fire could follow and did.
So when they got home, how much time did they have to get those horses?
Well, the thing, there was a trailer at our AI center, which is less than 1/4 mile from there, and we're charging into blackness of night. I mean, the sun's disappeared, and he's in front of me, and I stop and get the pickup and trailer, and I can start to see, I can't see flames, but I can start to see the orange glow of the approaching fire, and I'm going like, "Oh gosh," and I roll into his housing complex, and immediately we meet the fire at the back door, and I look at this situation. And I'm going like, "There's no way that we have time to back up a trailer to a barn and load horses. I mean, it's over with.
Yeah.
We're already too late." We were too late when he said, "Come to help me."
Right.
And at that point in time, when I pulled in there, Mark and Eva were standing in their yard and trying to make a plan.
Could you see them?
I could see them. They were 20 yards away from me when I pulled in there, and then they disappeared behind a wall of smoke. And
it's black smoke. It's not
black
gray.
Smoke. It's like somebody, if you had put a bandana around your head or a gunny sack, if you closed your eyes, that's what it looked like. And that right. was the experience. And I could see, I thought I could feel the intensity of the heat and the fire still maybe 100 yards away, but I could feel it.
Right.
And I could see little firefly embers out the dash. The
Are you still in the pickup?
I never got out of the pickup.
Okay.
But instantly as I drove in there and they disappeared from sight, I had a crashing feeling of self-preservation.
Right.
I got to get out of here. But at the same time, I have a crashing feeling on the other side of shame and guilt.
Right.
That.
And do you know where to go if you were to leave? I mean, can you see the road?
My compass is still working. You can't see the road.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But Mark's, to get in there, his front driveway is pipe and steel. Mm-hmm. So there's only one road in.
Right.
And I have a 30-foot trailer and a 1-ton dually pickup. And in the aftermath, thinking of what would have happened if that pickup is still there, neither one of them get out.
Right.
And so if I don't move at that time period, we all die.
Uh-huh.
And so, but the two feelings hitting me as I'm leaving, I'm being chastised on one side of my emotions for being a coward and leaving my family to die. On the other side, I'm trying to save myself and live. And so I get out, and as I leave, there's a tree belt that cordons off besides our feed pens and to gets out into the area of where the firemen were. And by this time, there already were some firemen there. And I could not see anything, but I could hear the tree belt exploding in fire beside me as I drove by.
Is it a cedar tree belt?
It's a cedar tree belt.
Yeah.
And I could still hear that thunder of explosion beside me. And when I got to the courtyard, which is a large open area in front of one of our barns, and I didn't know who he was at the time, but it was Tyler Wolfolk that I found out later on.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me, and we were side by side, face to face, and could barely hear each other over the roar of the wind and everything else. And he said wistfully and hopefully, he goes, "You are the last one out of there." And I said, "No, Mark and Eva are still down there." And there is a picture taken by my brother Garth that I saw several weeks later. It was Tyler that had made the comment. He goes, "I've never seen anything in my life so scary." And at the time, this is all under God's plan, because if we had seen that, we would have been paralyzed. You know, if we'd have seen 60, 80, 100-foot wall of flames. But because we were completely blind and we moved on faith, we got out. But Tyler and them, they couldn't go down in there. And so Eva came shortly out after me, behind me.
Uh-huh.
And then the interesting thing about this is, when you see this in the aftermath, if Mark had tried to come out that same way that Eva and I got out, he would have never made it. It would have been another death trap, because the cattle in this side of the pen had panicked and popped open a gate when that tree belt was on fire.
Right.
And in many instances, a lot of the ranchers, and we had seen this happen, but the cattle almost were like they were thinking they were defending themselves, but they ran into the fire. And so there were 15 to 16 dead carcasses in a solid cement bunk on one side, a tree belt on the other. If Mark would have chose to drove out that way, he would have been in a death trap there.
Yeah.
But he, inside of his house, was able to see enough outside there that he saw Eva's pickup was gone, and he knew it was hit time for him to get out. He also knew that the horse barn was starting on fire. And so as it blew by the fire, like you talked earlier, he went into it. But to get to his pickup, he had to run through the yard on fire. And he got in his pickup. And when he circled around, he did not go through that corridor, but he went back, went through the fire, and went on the back side of it to get to the horse barn. Well, it probably was a shorter time than I told all the publications and interviews later. I estimated that it was a half hour. I don't think it was that long now in retrospect. But sometime shortly thereafter, which Eva and I were together out on the wheat field and found each other, but neither one of us knew where Mark was. And Tyler was the man that came along, and he took off his face mask and his oxygen tank, and he said, "We've got confirmation that he's alive."
So he was on a fire truck? or was he
Tyler?
Tyler.
He was.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, in the aftermath, we got to the horse barn. And
once that fire went through and it quit being dark, like, and you could see each other and stuff, and you could tell what was going on, right? It was still light.
Yeah, I mean, on that side of the world, the fuel had been used up. I mean,
yeah.
The haystacks and hay was on fire. Once we met Mark up, you know, their house was on fire.
Right.
I mean, we stood together and watched it burn. We got the fire stopped and saved the horse barn.
Yeah.
But as a family, there was Mark and Eva and Ransom and I.
Mm-hmm.
We watched his house burn to the ground.
There wasn't any other alternative, was there?
Oh, no. And the interesting part of the story, I mean, that morning whenever Starbuck, the first flame was lit,
mm-hmm.
history was written for all of us. I mean, there was nobody that could have saved. What was going to burn was going to burn, you know. And in the aftermath, there were firemen that were really heart-wrenched that they'd lost. They came as hard as they could from Inglewood to try to help Mark's house because they knew that was the corridor it was going to,
right.
And what was in front of it.
Right.
And they said when it hit, it was running 80 to 100 mile an hour. And in an instant, I mean, there was no humanly way to save it. And, you know, none of us blame any of them. I mean, it just happened.
Yeah. So did it take a long time for their house to burn down, or was it like...
It was
5 or 10 minutes and we're gone?
Well, in a short time period, I mean, the roof was collapsing. But it was still on fire the next day, smoldering and flames in some of the wood area. But, you know, a lot of people asked in the aftermath, if you'd had a tile roof and stucco walls, would that have made any difference? I said, that's exactly what Mark's house was. Tile roof and stucco walls.
It really
cooked it.
Yeah, it did. So what about your family? Where were they while this was going on? Did they know where you were?
They did not know, and it's good that they didn't. In the aftermath.
Did they leave? Were they still at the house?
When they got the mandatory evacuation, Debbie called me and said, well, where do I go? I said, you can't outrun it. You're going to die if you try to run. I said, come down to the wheat field and get on the wheat field. And so she and my daughter Sierra were in the vehicle, and they rode it out there. Interestingly enough, in God's plan, we were able to, our house was saved. And for many days afterwards, a lot of our interns and helpers and Mark's family, the next morning was the only time for a couple hours we lost electricity. I don't know why, because mm-hmm. we must have been routed a different way, because a lot of poles were down between Inglewood and Ashland. And mm-hmm. But we had power, but she was cooking meals throughout that night. People could come get a shower at our place. And for many of us, it was many days that before we could ever get the smell out of our nose and out of our clothes, but it was with us for a long time. A
couple weeks.
Yeah. But
So when you're standing down there watching the fire, and you know the house is gone, and you know you saw those dead cattle there probably in that lane.
There were some of them there. Mm-hmm.
So did you start making a plan of what we're doing next?
That night was mostly just reaction. For us, it was the short time period of shock. I mean, the good thing is darkness, as the night evolved, the fire was accentuated in the darkness because every tree belt and tree and house that had burned was still on fire. And you just couldn't comprehend in your mind that the whole world's on fire and in every direction. There was no horizon without fire out there.
And it was high fire, right?
Yes. Yeah. And as far as the eye could see, and then for 48 hours, Tuesday morning was round two, and as the wind switched and burned what it hadn't burned the day before, but it was clear into Wednesday morning before we got up and looked out and did not see fire.
And Monday, after the fire and the wind went through, was it still awfully windy?
Oh, yeah. It continued, and see, as everything had been predicted up for that day to be a red flag warning day, And as the high winds from the south-southwest had come through, they talked about equally high winds coming back from the north. And when the front came out of the north and brought the fire, that the Starbuck fire had met up with the Mineola fire, and then those two fires turned back and dropped their vengeance towards Ashland again.
Mm-hmm.
It remained windy most of the night. Temperature dropped.
Yeah, do you remember when the temperature dropped? It's cold now?
It was 8 or 9 o'clock, but as we had tried to figure out and moved around the parameters of the ranch, we'd gone over to the Dunn Ranch, and Mark and Eva had gone over there, and if they hadn't, this had been another sad portion of the story, but the wind had switched, and it dropped the fire into the tree belt, and it was working its way back to all the Dunn Ranch houses,
mm-hmm.
and so one of the garages was on fire, and they didn't have electricity, had no way to pump any water, but they were throwing dirt on it. But this was close to midnight, and for lack of not knowing who to call, he calls me, and he goes, "If you can get some fire trucks in here, I think we can save this." And I'm joking inside of my mind. I'm going like, "Do I look like a fireman? I'm not on the fire department." And so I call the only fireman I know, is Scott Toon. I said, "I don't know where y'all are, Scott." And he answered on top of this.
Right.
He goes, "I don't know where you are. I don't know what your circumstances are. But if you can break anything loose to come to the Dunn complexes, it's about to go up in flames. If we can get there, we can stop it." And they broke two tankers loose, and they got down there, and it was about to burn up over 100-year-old barn and all the other houses there.
Did you find out where he was at?
I don't know where they came from, but they were close enough. They weren't very far away.
Yeah.
And when they broke off. And so they got that put out. And I'm coming back around to your temperature change. A lot of these stories take a long way to get around the circle. But we had another friend that was having a meeting at Woodward, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And he had ordered a lot of steaks for the meeting. Well, because of the fires that were even in Oklahoma, it wasn't very well attended. And so when they came out and started listening to the radio after the meeting, and the people in charge of it all said, "Well, you bought all this meat. You might as well take these ribeye steaks and the food with you." And he's going, "What am I going to do with the food?" Well, he found out what was going on, and he knew it was hitting us. And so he ends up at 1 o'clock in the morning. He's at the Dunn Ranch facility, and he has all this meat, and the temperature's dropped, and he makes contact with Mark and Eva, and he goes, "Is there anything I could do?" And he goes, Mark said, "Well, if you had a coat, I need a coat." And that's how cold it had dropped. But the other part of this circular story, the firemen that he fed there stopped to eat.
Right.
And while they were there, the fire rekindled. And in that night, that time period of everything that happened, they would have normally rolled in there, stopped what they thought, had it contained, and then they were off to try and do something else. If they hadn't stopped to eat those steaks and been there when it fired up again, the first stoppage would have been all for naught, and all those buildings would have burned. But there they were.
Was that the first meal that they had all day?
More than likely.
Because they left like at noon, I think. So, and do you know how many firefighters were there? How many trucks?
Well, it was those two tankers and
maybe a brush truck?
Yeah. There may have been three total.
Right.
And I don't know how many guys are on there to man that, but maybe there were 5, 6, 7, 8 guys.
Yeah, maybe.
But they got some good steaks that night.
To be in the right place.
There you go.
So did you lose anything in the fire?
We lost substantially a lot, but we didn't lose what was important.
When you talk about loss, you're talking about the Gardner Angus Ranch as a whole?
As a whole. In our upfront losses, we lost Mark's house and a few of his outbuildings there. We lost mm-hmm. a tractor there, and we lost a Ranger four-wheel drive all-terrain vehicle that we'd used for calving that was one of the guys had left in the pasture. He was going to use it the next morning. and it was a frame left.
Yes.
But the biggest asset that we lost was we lost 600 cows that burned up in the fire. And I say burn up, the fire caused their demise. Now, there were quite a few of them that lived, but had to be destroyed afterwards. And then the double hit on that was all of them were bred, and so they were either calving or going to calve the next fall. Yeah. And interestingly enough, and then of course we didn't know at the time until daylight, we lost over 270 miles of fence that was totally destroyed and either had to be totally replaced or repaired to put back. And so basically we as a ranch, we lost all of our infrastructure.
Right. So did you have any fenced places that you could put the cattle that survived?
Well, we did a little bit, and those would have been wheat pasture areas, or if those wheat pastures were right next to a grass pasture that the grass burnt, those fences were easier repaired quickly,
right?
And we could put cattle on the wheat pasture. But the flip side of it is, in its total destruction and devastation, there wasn't much to bring to those wheat fields.
That's right.
If they were on there, they lived. If they weren't.
So you didn't have to go gather cattle from other people.
Not a large amount.
It's pretty much gone. So since there was lots of cattle that had sufficient burns or other things that happened during the fire, did you have help in putting them down?
Yeah, and that was one of the great blessings of all that. As we talked about and you look back on it, I mean, this event drove home to me how we still live on the frontier, you know, and many times people recalled throughout the 2 days that they've called for help and there was no one to come. And in your secluded mindset, you're thinking, well, this is, we hope this is just happening to us, you know, and we didn't really know the size and the scope of what the community and the county was dealing with. But as pieces of information started to gather, and one of the great helps that I had was Larry Conrady. And on Tuesday, he had made it down to our place. And he had been helping destroy cattle north of town with Giles's and Bo's Idens. And Larry leases the Dunn Ranch for hunting rights, so he knows it very intimately. And we hadn't even got over there yet, but we knew that there were a vast amount of cows out there. But you still hope against hope that they're okay, that they're not damaged beyond saving. But as we made our plan there, he said, well, what can I do? And I said, well, if what I'm hearing is true, I need you to go over to that ranch and start putting down cows. I'll start on this side. He goes, well, how do I know? I said, Larry, you'll know. And he knew. But
so what about wildlife, too? Was there a lot of that?
Interestingly, about what I saw on Tuesday morning, I was standing on Angle Road by Big Sand Creek and just kind of observing the world. And I saw deer walk by, and what was left of some hanging wire, this deer just walked right into the wire, and it kind of spooked him that something touched him, and I still didn't quite understand. And then he kind of shot off across what was left of the road, hit the other side of what was left of that fence, but that deer was burned blind in his eyes. But when we got to the ranch and went along the Cimarron River on Wednesday, Larry had been down there and he had a clue of what was there to be seen. But as we walked down there and started putting down cows that needed to be put down, There are three men. One reporter, Mike Pence from the Wichita Eagle, was with me, and my good friend Philip Messer had come down to be a part of it and help us. And Philip said at that time, he said, "Stop and listen." And we did. And I was a multitude of things on my mind. I'm going like, "What?" But it was just deathly quiet. There were no birds. There were no crickets. It was just utterly silence. So in answer to your question, as we walked through there, you would see everything from dead deer, burn-up coyotes, rabbits, squirrels. Everything that lives in southwest Kansas was consumed in that fire.
Yep, didn't have anywhere to go.
And, you know, when the coyotes and the deer can't outrun it, big old bread cow not going to be outrunning it.
So when did people, besides the guy with the stakes, when did people start showing up to help?
We had calls that were people were wanting to come on Tuesday. Literally, if they had of, they would have run through a firewall north of Jim Cox's residence in that area. There's three quarters of CRP that hadn't burned the night before. And then the wind switch and the moldering embers of the cottonwoods that were burned up, it started all that on. And that fire actually headed towards Phil and Marianne Cunningham's house. And Preston had farmed the night before a fire break around their house, and that probably saved their house. But they are one of the people that had called, and whoever answered the call said there's no one to send. And so they fought it off themselves what best they could, but their preparation the night before had saved it. But people, one of the most more touching things that I experienced throughout the night, on Monday night, I actually got to see Ashland. And a lot of people through Hollywood don't understand history very well, but the history of the Alamo attack actually started before daybreak and was in the dark. And some movies have tried to do it justice in recent history, but the flares and the flyers that went up. But as I looked down into the little valley of Ashland that night on Monday night, you know, I said a prayer, but it looked like the Alamo. You know, it was just ringed, and I thought, I may never see my hometown again.
Yep.
But
so when it came time to bury cattle, did you have somebody come out with, or did you do that yourself, or did...
Some of both.
Did the game wardens come and help? Or were they... Did you have a vet on site?
The interesting part, there were time periods where they asked.
Yep.
Or they said, well, you're going to have to do all these regulations.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that was good, Mark was in the vehicle with Sam Brownback, Governor Brownback, when he came. And the governor said, do what you have to do.
Right.
But literally, in the aftermath, one of my comments was, you know, the white man came to this country and shot 10 million buffalo. They didn't bury any of them.
Mm-mm.
And the world kept turning.
Yeah,
where we could get to the cattle and we had solid enough ground to dig underneath and we could bury them, we did. We have several mass graves throughout the ranch. But there's other large kill zones that you couldn't get to and dig because of the water tables.
Right.
And you'd hit water.
Yeah.
Or in sand, and you'd tear up more stuff than you could. And
yeah.
So we let nature clean it up. But I don't think I finished answering one of your questions about, you know, literally when I, on Wednesday morning, throughout the night and the travels of Monday and Tuesday, I knew I had soft tires on my pickup and nails. And so I needed to get to the feed store to get tires fixed and go see what the rest of it was going to be like. And the first thing that I meet coming off the highway is a semi load of hay.
Ooh.
You know, so the cavalry's on the way Wednesday morning.
Yeah.
That's how quick it was. You know, the calls that we got Tuesday, I said, don't come. You can't get in here. But Wednesday, they came.
Yep.
And they kept coming and kept coming.
For a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So did you have any volunteers out at your house?
We did.
Your ranch?
And it was... this whole thing was a learning experience like no other. You know, how you coordinate a large group of people that want to help you when you don't even know what to do or what needs to be done at first. But we had a large amount of volunteers and from high school kids, from Kansas State University College. It was spring break and they showed up. Throughout the rest of the time period, we had different Mennonite relief help come in. But the biggest thing and the greatest help that we had were people that cleared fencing, which, going back to one of your other questions, we also needed to not... one of the things that we needed to be cognizant of, we needed to take pictures of the burnout fence to document the fences were destroyed.
Yes.
You know, we did that without an extra veterinary on site to document the dead cattle in our inventory numbers, and we worked with Randall Spare, the veterinary.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't have a specific veterinary running with us to document the cattle and the cattle that we put down or that they needed put down. We did that all by ourselves. But the people that came in with the excavator, they dug some holes. We had front-end loader, and for neighbor Vince Eisenbart, who lost basically his whole herd, we found that herd next to one of our pastures, and we buried those for him with our unit. But the volunteers, once... and this is another thing. When you have a fence that's completely destroyed and you want to replace it, you need to know the right-of-way. And you need to know your starting point or leave some marker. And we're like, well, leave some posts if there's some stubs or something or a T-post. Don't pull everything because we need to know where to shoot our new line for our new fences. But, yes, we had a lot of volunteers show up.
So the kids that came out from K-State, were some of them pre-vet students?
They were different agriculture clubs.
Like block
and bridle.
Yeah, farmhouse.
Yeah, I don't know if there might have been some farmhouse members, but per se it was more like the block and bridle club or things like that.
So for how long did you have volunteers? Were they here for weeks or months? Do you still have volunteers stop by?
Oh, we have from that time period. I have truck drivers that have called back to check on us. And I was thinking about you, how you get along, how far are you, have you recovered? I would say for us, first couple months, we had, you know, the first 2 weeks was intense. Then we had help off and on for a couple months. But once those fences were somewhat cleaned up and picked up, one of the things that because there's no playbook for this and there's no way of knowing what to do and how to do what you need to do, one of the good things that happened for us was the fire was on March 6th. April 1st, we had a production sale. And so once we got what we had to salvaged and put up a little fence, our focus switched on trying to go forward and have that production sale. And that was a good thing because it gave us time to take a breath and then see what we actually really wanted to do and how we go about putting the infrastructure and the fences back. And so after we had that time period to think a little bit, one of the things that we did, and this is a continuing blessing, and people will say, well, how can that be a blessing? But the Anderson Creek fire the summer before, a lot of those fence crews who had dealt over there, well, those professionals moved to Clark County.
Right.
And several of them approached us, and we hired four full-time professional fence crews to go to work for us. And once the volunteers had cleaned up the mess, and then they could come in there and shoot their lines. And then as we broke down the government interpretations of what we were supposed to do to try to be able to get a little cost sharing, those were some other things and hurdles that we needed to jump and hoops to go through. But once we understood the kind of materials that we were supposed to use and go back and meet compliance, that gap that I talk about from just getting out there and doing something, we got to do something.
Yeah.
You know, we let that subside, and so we could make a solid plan. And then as we go through, we understood that this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to reorganize the parameters of pastures that we didn't like the way they were once. Why did they put that fence through that sand dune? Let's go out around on the flat of the sand dune.
Yeah.
So we changed the boundaries and perimeters of fences, which was a good thing. And so in the aftermath, it took us 9 months, but we've never been in better shape infrastructure-wise in the history of the ranch.
So you have all the fences done?
We're completely rebuilt.
Are Mark and Eva going to rebuild the house, or are they?
Today, they actually were, on May 1st, they were talking with contractors and the people that have been building several of the community houses here, the Bozidens and Giles.
Yep.
They're now, Mark's on their list. And the good thing about Mark and his situation, they had, with our new facility that we built, we had apartments and so they've been living in our sale barn for the last year. But it's a pretty nice sale barn.
Yeah, it is. So what about Debbie? Did she do a lot of cooking for
she
the volunteers?
Did.
While
well, the interesting thing about the volunteers, everything keeps happening, and you don't understand why. But in the middle of the preceding next week, I had a man call from Lubbock, Texas. He was a chuck wagon cook, and he felt compelled. He wanted to come feed people.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, leave your chuck wagon and your Dutch ovens at home, because we don't have any firewood up here.
Right.
And I said, you can cook out of our kitchen there at the sale barn. And I'm going like, well, who are the people I'm going to feed? And God had it all planned out, and as the volunteers came, somebody needed to feed them.
Right.
And this man had another helper with him, and they cook three meals a day. And in that week's time period, they fixed over 600 meals.
Cool.
And those are meals I didn't know that were needing to be fixed. But the chuck wagon cook took care of them.
So where do you get his food from?
Well, there's another God thing. When he started going around Lubbock or starting to put together some orders that he thought he would need, and people found out that he was coming to the Starbuck Fire Zone, people just started giving him donations.
Right.
And he called me the day before he was going to leave, and he said, do you have any extra freezer space? I said, no, but I can fix that. He goes, I'm going to have a lot of frozen food that is being accrued as we go forward.
Right.
He goes, but I need some place to store it. I'll put it on ice to get there. Mm-hmm. Well, I called Ferguson's and I need your biggest chest freezer. And we got it down here and plugged in on Saturday morning and cooled down. And Monday we loaded it and pushed the lid down. But people just in Lubbock and down there found out what he was doing, and they'd give him so much bacon, or go get so many potatoes, or and he had thousands of bottles of water, cases of water. And I said, well, let's bring the food and leave some water down there in Texas for your next feed or your next fire. But literally with the bottles and cases of water that were left during this time period, with whether it was hay trucks coming in or just people, we literally could put the next fire out just pouring a bottle of water.
Yep. So did you ever come to town and go to the camp where they were cooking meals?
I did not.
Did you go to the high school anytime?
I came in on the we'd gone through that, was it the first week? And
did you come in for the dinner on that Sunday?
I came in on Easter Sunday, and I went to church, and Senator Moran was there. And then they told about all these supplies. If you need anything, please come to the high school. And I was out of toothpaste. And I went to the high school, and I said, well, I'll go get some toothpaste. And I was just overwhelmed when I stepped into the hall. And I just couldn't believe it. And I found my toothpaste.
It's a wonder.
And then the meat truck that they were unloading frozen meat stopped there and got some boxes of food there to take home. But that was the only time I came to town during that. And so it was almost 6 days later.
Right.
The fire was on Monday the 6th, and the following Sunday was that. At that year, time period, it was Easter, and I came to church services then.
Yeah.
But, you know, I hadn't, later on, when donations had come in with different truck drivers, yeah. And I would, and they'd moved it to either the 4-H building or the vet shop in their extra storage unit, I would take extra clothing or supplies or whatever that needed to go there.
Yeah.
But,
So what's your most vivid memory of the fire?
Oh, probably Mark and Eva disappearing in that cloud of smoke. And then after that, you know, in the aftermath of the interviews that I did, and a lot of people say, well, how could you do what you did in the aftermath, which, you know, between Larry Conradi and his crew and all of us out there doing it, we probably had to put down 135 cows. And that shocks the outside world that you just walk up there and do that. But, I mean, you talk about needing to be done and mercy. But seeing that, you know, I never was in the service. Right. But literally we saw the horrors of war when you see a living animal standing there burnt. They can't see. Their eyes are burnt out. Their udders burn off. And I don't know how they're standing, but they're just nothing but buckskin leather standing there. And their mouths are open and panting a little bit. And some of them would be standing next to the bloated, cooked, dead ones that did die. And you know they're just, please kill me. But in the aftermath of all that, you know, people would ask that. And because of Mark and Eva and everybody living through it, you know, I did all that with a joyful heart, because when Philip Messer came down and told me, you know, I said to myself, he came down on Wednesday and he goes, well, how are you doing? I said, I'm not doing very good at all. And he said, well, what? And I said, well, and I told him about my emotional struggle standing there running away from my family, and yet I got to live and save myself. And he goes, well, you don't understand. You know, God told you to move. And when God told you to move, you didn't argue with him. You listened to him, and you moved. And I go, well, there wasn't any time to argue. And so, but when, you know, in my mind, God sent Philip for me to hear in human words his message to me.
Right.
And when Philip told me that, you talk about a weight just being lifted off my shoulders. Yes. And so in the aftermath, and that's why I come back and say, I did whatever we did with a joyful heart, because we were alive.
Yeah.
And those were just chores that we had to do every day. I mean, if we had to destroy these cows or we had to fix this fence or whatever, I was alive and my family was alive. And So
who were some of the people or agencies that proved most helpful? Obviously, Philip.
Yeah, I'll never forget Philip and Larry Conradi. You know, as we've all gone through this, everybody's had to deal with it in their own. It's a private deal, somewhat. I mean, we deal with our emotions every day in different. Mm-hmm. You know, in the aftermath of it all, there's people in our community that've got post-traumatic stress syndrome and are still trying to cope with it. You know, I had the gift from God that He took all of my my emotion away from it on that side of it. You know, so, the closeness of the community. I mean, like the veterinary center. But one of the things that was great. You know, you get so isolated and so consumed with what you're doing with in the aftermath. And I was doing chores that morning and getting ready to go out again. And Melanie Hink and Jan Endicott were going around the community handing out hot breakfast burritos.
Right.
And hugs.
Yeah.
And that was, at that moment, it was pretty.
It's one of the best things.
Yeah.
So what do you think? What effect? Physical, financial, emotional? Which one's had the biggest toll on you or on the community? You think there's a little bit of everything?
Yeah, and it, you know, obviously it's an emotional deal. The emotion takes over everything. It's all consuming, from the bad portions of it to the joyful portions and the ability to see the goodness in mankind. You know, the people in the agriculture world that came to our rescue, you know, that's just beyond belief to this day. And when you see trucks lined up for a mile and a half, you know, they've driven 24 hours and they're lining up for another hour and a half for you to get them unloaded at nighttime or midnight, you know, and they want to help you.
Yeah.
And, but the thing I find interesting as a community, and it's said many times by a lot of the leaders, you never heard anybody say, "I'm going to quit." There's never anybody said, "I'm not going to rebuild," and use it as a chance to get out. And I'm proud of the community for all the interviews, and I've had multiple people say, "Man, you know, your community was so impressive with the interviews and the television, and I'm proud of their education, being able to speak to the public and tell our story." But
and nobody complained.
No, you know, and it's not a story of what happened to us, because in production agriculture, we understand that these things happen. Now, does it happen to the scope of what this was? We'll never understand that. But there will be more fires. There'll be more tornadoes. There'll be more disasters, droughts, hail, snow, blizzards. But those are the risks that come with what we do, trying to feed the people of the world. And so the financial side of it, you know, the fact that we're back in our infrastructure is built, our inventories of cattle have been replaced, the fences are back. You know, that's by the goodness of people that poured in money to KLA, and checks were cut to our community from them, from the Working Cowboy Ranch Association, the Ashland Foundation. You know, midsummer, I didn't know whether we could keep going or not, and we got a large check from KLA, and I'm going like, well, maybe we can keep doing this, and then Ashland Foundation. And so when the banks were able to, you know, obviously, as much as anybody, they're hooked to the agriculture, you know, and a lot of their assets got burnt and destroyed in this, and loans on cattle that weren't going to be replaced. But when they gave low interest loans for us to keep operating and lines of credit and keep everybody going, you know, that was hats off to them. And so, yes, it's going to take time financially. The financial part of healing is going to take the most time, as we've all been shocked that we've rebuilt very quickly, but you know, all of us that rebuilt have got extra zeros on our debt line, and it's going to take some time for that to heal.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that completely answers your question, but it's all of the above.
Yep. So this was a wildfire that we've never seen before, but we live in a place where there's always has been range fires.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably have some family history of range fires or some stories. But how would you compare this? Or
there's
any way?
There's no comparison.
And when you left Dodge that day, were you perceiving that this was going to be a regular fire?
Well, I figured that it'd be a regular fire. I mean, it may burn 4,000 or 5,000 acres, or, you know, they'll get it stopped. They in quotations, they always right. get it stopped.
Yeah.
And because it was a monster unlike anything we'd ever seen, none of us knew what was coming towards us. If we'd had, we'd have never got we never got out of bed that morning. We might have burned down. But it's something that my age bracket, I missed being drafted, eligible for the draft in Vietnam. Vietnam closed in 72. They're about to shut it down then.
74.
And so then. So in 74, I still had, I had 2 years away from being in draftable service. But there's something weird in my makeup, because you saw that during your time period. I know that I didn't, but I felt like I missed something. I didn't experience something. I've experienced Starbuck, and that's all I need to see.
You're good, right?
I'm good.
So, can you perceive of anything positive that's resulted from the fire?
Many things, many things. You know, the strength of our community, the strength of our people, you know, the blessings of life. You know, you think about the kids in McLean, Texas, and those were beautiful people. They were youngsters in their 20s, in the prime of life. One couple was fixing to get married. You know, there's a life they'll never have, and it's snuffed out. And for our community, I look back on it, and we easily, when you hear all the stories, we could have buried 15 or 20 people. And this Starbuck fire for Ashland, Kansas, would have had a different taste in all of our mouths if we just started going to a bunch of funerals. And so you talk about the positiveness and the goodness of that. You know, God looked out for Ashland, Kansas that day, and for a lot of people, and that's the beauty of it. And so I see nothing but positiveness out of it.
Yep. So what can you do, or have you done, to prepare for a future fire? Or what can the community do, or have they done?
One of the things that we leaned on the Anderson Creek fire heavily, watching them replace their fences and infrastructure going back, we copied them. And so, yes, was it more expensive? But we're investing back into our business and our ranch. But we went back in with pipe corner posts. Mm-hmm. We went back in with steel T-posts. One of the things that somebody sent me early on, and I threw it in my desk drawer and didn't ever go back to look at it until later when we had time to breathe and make a plan. And I thought, well, maybe this might work. But there was a fellow that sent me a deal about what I call them ring posts, but they're pipe posts with wire ring washers welded onto them that you could lay the wire into and then close the washer.
Oh.
And so it was the washer acts as a steeple. And so they're 8 foot by 2 inches, and they have a large anchor wedge welded towards the bottom of the post. And you drive this post into the ground, and it's driven in with a vibrator on a skidster. And so you don't have to dig a post. It's already tamped. You don't have to dig a hole, excuse me. You don't have to tamp it and put the dirt back in. It just and goes in place. And so where we normally would have put a wood post where there's creosote or hedge,
right,
we put these ring pipe posts. And so in essence, we have put back a steel and pipe fence everywhere we could. And the irony of all of that, unfortunately for all of us, we had a little test run on March 5th of this year. And some of the same area that we'd rebuilt the fence with that fire, it blew through those brand new pipe fences and it was beautiful. It just went on and everything was fine. And so hopefully that will, in future generations, when they do have fires, the fences will still be standing when they go back out to check what disaster had taken place. And then community-wise, the funny thing after that fire on March 5th of 2018, I had one of the local leaders call me and he goes, "Well, how's your blood pressure?" And I said, knowing who he was, I said, "Well, are you still in the command center post?" And he goes, "Well, I just left the command center." But they had already gone into action much earlier, I assume, than they did in 2017. Right. But the community was prepared. The difference in getting that fire stopped, which all of us were aghast a year to the date, the first Monday in March, and here we go again. And everybody's like, "You got to be kidding me." But when the call went out for help that time, and they weren't fighting everywhere else, and they got everything in here with all assets and hammered it down and shut it down on the same kind of a day, that shows you what could have been done. But there was preparedness and there was readiness, and they were good to go, and they hit it and got it put out. So the lessons have been learned, and I think for the most part, you know, as history goes, as time goes by, those that continue to live here will have to look back, what did they do? But it was also interesting and a pride factor when the Montana fires started up throughout the summer in 2017, a lot of those communities up there followed the model of what Ashland did. And so the outside world was watching us too. And that's been one of the portions of the story that if there's any pressure point to it, you know, so many of the outside world has poured in their resources, whether it be hay, supplies, cash contributions, but they're investing in Ashland. And, you know, for those of us that are residents, it's up to us to rebuild it and not waste their resources and their investment in us as a community. And so I think everybody's learned something and they'll go forward.
So you said you gave a lot of interviews right after the fire to newspapers and stuff, and then you've gone to different organizations and kind of spread the word of what you did and how things happened. What are some of the things that they are most interested in learning that you learned from the fire?
Oh, a lot of it is what we just talked about, is how you rebuild. Mm-hmm.
What about your cattle? Because you said you lost a lot of bred cattle and stuff, and there were a lot of other, not a whole lot of cattle salvaged afterwards, but could you notice a lot of effects on those cattle, like breathing problems or stuff like that after the fire?
Interestingly enough, there was not, as we talked about earlier, if you had fire effects, you were dead. The effect of the fire, you were dead. But later on, one of the things that we noticed the following fall of first calf heifers that started to calve, a lot of those had been salvaged or saved because they were on wheat pasture. But for what I'm fixing to say, I think they had to get to the wheat pasture. But we had a lot of foot issues where it took that much time for it to express itself. And in the first portion of the calving season, with the stress that they endured, we saw early abortions, that the calves were being born 30 days early. And my thought process, how could you live through that hellfire inferno and then almost be within 30 days of calving, but yet now is the stress time that in the calves were born premature and dead. The cows that had trouble with those kind of calving, for whatever reason, they didn't dilate. So little 50-pound calves, if you didn't get them pulled out, the mothers themselves died. And we saw instances of that. So foot issues and just probably delayed stress or stress that finally expressed itself in those forms. But the interesting thing on the cattle that were confined and did consume a lot of smoke, we didn't have any issues with that. And one of the things that scared me to death, and I didn't even want to ask the question, but for 48 hours, a lot of the bulls that were going to be in the bull sale were in the prevailing wind, and the wind was just forcing all that burning hay smoke into them. And well, and the veterinaries told us, you'll know in a week. And fortunately, they stayed bright, they stayed eating. We didn't have any effects that way.
When you go out and give these programs and show the slides of the area at the time, what are some of the comments that you get back from the people that weren't here and didn't experience it?
Sometimes it's not so much comments as there are sobs.
Oh, yeah.
And that's one of the reactions. I mean, literally, you have people sobbing in the crowd. And because they ask you to come, I mean, you try not to flower it up. I mean, this is what happened, and this is the pictures of reality, and you show the lines of dead cattle piled up and the mass graves, but then we also show the goodness of the trucks unloading supplies and the people coming and the happier side of it. But a lot of them want to know your original emotions and what happened. But one of the things that I came quickly to understand is you can't ever stop. I mean, in the aftermath, all of us, whether it's community-wise or individual-wise, but personally, you just kept moving.
Yep.
And so one of the good things, they're not with us anymore, but my mother died in June 22nd of this year, and she somewhat experienced the Starbuck. I don't know if she knew much about it, but the Ashland was evacuated, and she was in the nursing home, and she was evacuated to Woodward, and there's some funny stories that go with that. But Mom and Dad were excellent teachers, and so every day of our life, unbeknownst to us, we have been in training, and so in the aftermath of this, we didn't know we knew what to do, but we kept moving, and we did it. And so that's one of the great things about, and Mark had talked at one of his talks, he goes, you know, I never have known if our generation could ever measure up to the greatest generation, the World War II veterans. And I told people that we've had it tough, but we didn't have to charge the beaches of Normandy and fight our way to Berlin. But we had an opportunity for us in this community to have a challenge and step up and meet it. And I think we've done well. But the people in those places, and it's hard to show pictures and get the dramaticness and like, as those of us that lived it, and I mean, you're literally, we're in an apocalyptic landscape. And it's like, I told in one of the talks, I said, I don't want to be over dramatic here, but this is a biblical event. I mean, everything is gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, to portray that to your audience, pictures don't do it justice. Mm-hmm. And so, but, you know, they're curious about things we've talked about today. You know, how did you deal with the dead cattle? How did you rebuild? How did you get financial help? How did you, deal with the onslaught of health? And so, It's interesting, but you know, Mark has had the opportunity to go to speak on this, and he was a speaker at Nashville, Tennessee, and a large certified Angus beef presentation, and there were 850 people there, and when he walked off the stage, they were giving him a standing ovation and all crying, and in the aftermath of that, they have a big fundraising auction and for a golf tournament.
Yeah.
And there's several great big corporate sponsors. And they had the auction, and then the guys that were the big contributors to this, they said, you know, they got together and they said, let's send all that money to the Ashland Foundation. And they wrote a check for $87,000.
Goodness.
And it was all because of his talk.
Yeah.
And his presentation. And those people had no idea that they were going to do that. Mm-hmm. But that's been the response of some of them.
Yeah.
You know, let's do more. Let's help. And so that poured right into the Ashland Foundation. And so it's been good to go out and tell our story. But as I've said before, now as time's passed, and a lot of people say, well, I bet you're tired of talking about the fire. I'm maybe one of your last people.
I could bench it.
But, you know, for good or bad, the Starbuck fire is part of our history, and it's now part of our story.
Yep.
And so.
So you got any other thoughts?
I'm glad to be alive, and I'm glad I've experienced something. But no, and those that hear this or read this later on in history, long after this, maybe can't comprehend how much turmoil our country has been in leading up to that time period. But we got to see the goodness of mankind firsthand, and how good people really are, and their kindness and their generosity, and that's one of the beautiful things to come out of this deal. And so, you know, those are the thoughts, and I'm proud to be from Ashland, Kansas.
Yep. Thank you for sharing your story.
You're more than welcome.